realized that they would have to talk about politics with a flesh-and-blood human being, rather than having their views affirmed by their Facebook feeds. Within the two-dimensional internet world, new collectivities have arisen, invisible by the light of day, tribes with distinct worldviews, beholden to manipulations. And yes, there is a conspiracy that you can find online. It's the one to keep you online looking for conspiracies. We need print journalists so that stories can develop on the page and in our minds. What does it mean, for example, that the president says that women belong at home, that pregnancy is an inconvenience, that mothers do not give 100% at work, that women should be punished for having abortions, that women are slobs, pigs, or dogs, and that it is permissible to sexually assault them? What does it mean that six of the president's companies have gone bankrupt and that the president's enterprises have been financed by mysterious infusions of cash from entities in Russia and Kazakhstan? We can learn these things on various media. When we learn them from a screen, however, we tend to be drawn in by the logic of spectacle. When we learn of one scandal, it whets our appetite for the next. Once we subliminally accept that we are watching a reality show rather than thinking about real life, no image can actually hurt the president politically. Reality television must become more dramatic with each episode. If we found a video of the president performing Cossack dances while Vladimir Putin claps, we would probably just demand the same thing with the president wearing a bear suit and holding rubles in his mouth. The better print journalists allow us to consider the meaning for ourselves and our country of what might otherwise seem to be isolated bits of information. But while anyone can repost an article, researching and writing is hard work that requires time and money. Before you deride the mainstream media, note that it is no longer the mainstream. It is derision that is mainstream and easy, and actual journalism that is edgy and difficult. So try for yourself to write a proper article involving work in the real world, traveling, interviewing, maintaining relationships with sources, researching in written records, verifying everything, writing and revising drafts, all on a tight and unforgiving schedule. If you find you like doing this, keep a blog. In the meantime, give credit to those who do all of that for a living. Journalists are not perfect, any more than people in other vocations are perfect. But the work of people who adhere to journalistic ethics is of a different quality than the work of those who do not. We find it natural that we pay for a plumber or a mechanic, but demand our news for free. If we did not pay for plumbing or auto repair, we would not expect to drink water or drive cars. Why then should we form our political judgment on the basis of zero investment? We get what we pay for. If we do pursue the facts, the internet gives us enviable power to convey them. The authorities cited here had nothing of the kind. Leszek Kołakowski, the great Polish philosopher and historian, lost his chair at Warsaw University for speaking out against the communist regime and could not publish. The first quotation in this book, from Hannah Arendt, came from a pamphlet entitled We Refugees, a miraculous achievement written by someone who had escaped a murderous Nazi regime. A brilliant mind like Viktor Klemperer, much admired today, is remembered only because he stubbornly kept a hidden diary under Nazi rule. For him, it was sustenance. My diary was my balancing pole, without which I would have fallen down 1,000 times. Václav Havel, the most important thinker among the communist dissidents of the 1970s, dedicated his most important essay, The Power of the Powerless, to a philosopher who died shortly after interrogation by the Czechoslovak communist secret police. In communist Czechoslovakia, this pamphlet had to be circulated illegally in a few copies, as what East Europeans at the time, following the Russian dissidents, called samizdat. If the main pillar of the system is living a lie, wrote Havel, then it is not surprising that the fundamental threat to it is living in truth. Since in the age of the internet we are all publishers, each of us bears some private responsibility for the public sense of truth. If we are serious about seeking the facts, we can each make a small revolution in the way the internet works. If you are verifying information for yourself, you will not send on fake news to others. If you choose to follow reporters whom you have reason to trust, you can also transmit what they have learned to others. If you retweet only the work of humans who have followed journalistic protocols, you are less likely to debase your brain interacting with bots and trolls. We do not see the minds that we hurt when we publish falsehoods, but that does not mean we do no harm. Think of driving a car. We may not see the other driver, but we know not to run into his car. We know that the damage will be mutual. We protect the other person without seeing him dozens of times every day. Likewise, although we may not see the other person in front of his or her computer, we have our share of responsibility for what he or she is reading there. If we can avoid doing violence to the minds of unseen others on the internet, others will learn to do the same. And then perhaps our internet traffic will cease to look like one great bloody accident. Lesson 12. Make eye contact and small talk. This is not just polite. It is part of being a citizen and a responsible member of society. It is also a way to stay in touch with your surroundings, break down social barriers, and understand whom you should and should not trust. If we enter a culture of denunciation, you will want to know the psychological landscape of your daily life. Tyrannical regimes arose at different times and places in the Europe of the 20th century, but memoirs of their victims all share a single tender moment. Whether the recollection is of fascist Italy in the 1920s, of Nazi Germany in the 1930s, of the Soviet Union during the Great Terror of 1937 to 1938, or of the purges in communist Eastern Europe in the 1940s and 1950s, people who were living in fear of repression remembered how their neighbors treated them. A smile, a handshake, or a word of greeting, banal gestures in a normal situation, took on great significance. When friends, colleagues, and acquaintances looked away or crossed the street to avoid contact, fear grew. You might not be sure today or tomorrow who feels threatened in the United States, but if you affirm everyone, you can be sure that certain people will feel better. In the most dangerous of times, those who escape and survive generally know people whom they can trust. Having old friends is the politics of last resort, and making new ones is the first step toward change. Lesson 13. Practice corporeal politics. Power wants your body softening in your chair and your emotions dissipating on the screen. Get outside. Put your body in unfamiliar places with unfamiliar people. Make new friends and march with them. For resistance to succeed, two boundaries must be crossed. First, ideas about change must engage people of various backgrounds who do not agree about everything. Second, people must find themselves in places that are not their homes and among groups who are not previously their friends. Protests can be organized through social media, but nothing is real that does not end on the streets. If tyrants feel no consequences for their actions in the three-dimensional world, nothing will change. The one example of successful resistance to communism was the Solidarity labor movement in Poland in 1980-1981. A coalition of workers and professionals, elements of the Roman Catholic Church, and secular groups. Its leaders had learned hard lessons under communism. In 1968, the regime mobilized workers against students who protested. In 1970, when a strike in Gdańsk on the Baltic coast was bloodily suppressed, it was the workers' turn to feel isolated. In 1976, however, intellectuals and professionals formed a group to assist workers who had been abused by the government. These were people from both the right and the left, believers and atheists, who created trust among workers, people whom they would otherwise not have met. When Polish workers on the Baltic coast went on strike again in 1980, they were joined by lawyers, scholars, and others who helped them make their case. The result was the creation of a free labor union, as well as government guarantees to observe human rights. During the 16 months that Solidarity was legal, 10 million people joined, and countless new friendships were created amid strikes, marches, and demonstrations. The Polish communist regime put down the movement with martial law in 1981. Yet 8 years later, in 1989, when they needed a negotiating partner, the communists had to turn to Solidarity. The labor union insisted on elections, which it then won. This was the beginning of the end of communism in Poland, Eastern Europe, and the Soviet Union. The choice to be in public depends on the ability to maintain a private sphere of life. We are only free when it is we ourselves who draw the line between when we are seen and when we are not seen. Lesson 14. Establish a private life. Nastier rulers will use what they know about you to push you around. Scrub your computer of malware on a regular basis. Remember that email is skywriting. Consider using alternative forms of the internet or simply using it less. Have personal exchanges in person. For the same reason, resolve any legal trouble. Tyrants seek the hook on which to hang you. Try not to have hooks. What the great political thinker Hannah Arendt meant by totalitarianism was not an all-powerful state, but the erasure of the difference between private and public life. We are free only insofar as we exercise control over what people know about us and in what circumstances they come to know it. During the campaign of 2016, we took a step towards totalitarianism without even noticing, by accepting as normal the violation of electronic privacy. Whether it is done by American or Russian intelligence agencies, or for that matter by any institution, the theft, discussion, or publication of personal communications destroys a basic foundation of our rights. If we have no control over who reads what and when, we have no ability to act in the present or plan for the future. Whoever can pierce your privacy can humiliate you and disrupt your relationships at will. No one, except perhaps a tyrant, has a private life that can survive public exposure by hostile directive. The timed email bombs of the 2016 presidential campaign were also a powerful form of disinformation. Words written in one situation make sense only in that context. The very act of removing them from their historical moment and dropping them into another is an act of falsification. What's worse, when media followed the email bombs as if they were news, they betrayed their own mission. Few journalists made an effort to explain why people said or wrote the things they did at the time. Meanwhile, in transmitting the privacy violations as news, the media allowed themselves to be distracted from the actual events of the day. Rather than reporting the violation of basic rights, our media generally preferred to mindlessly indulge the inherently salacious interest we have in other people's affairs. Our appetite for the secret, thought Arendt, is dangerously political. Totalitarianism removes the difference between private and public, not just to make individuals unfree, but also to draw the whole society away from normal politics and towards conspiracy theories. Rather than defining facts or generating interpretations, we are seduced by the notion of hidden realities and dark conspiracies that explain everything. As we learned from these email bombs, this mechanism works even when what is revealed is of no interest. The revelation of what was once confidential becomes the story itself. It is striking that news media are much worse at this than, say, fashion or sports reporters. Fashion reporters know that models are taking off their clothes in the changing rooms, and sports reporters know that athletes shower in the locker room, but neither allow private matters to supplant the public story they are supposed to be covering. When we take an active interest in matters of doubtful relevance at moments that are chosen by tyrants and spooks, we participate in the demolition of our own political order. To be sure, we might feel that we are doing nothing more than going along with everyone else. This is true, and it is what Arendt described as the devolution of a society into a mob. We can try to solve this problem individually by securing our own computers. We can also try to solve it collectively, by supporting, for example, organizations that are concerned with human rights. Lesson 15. Contribute to good causes. Be active in organizations, political or not, that express your own view of life. Pick a charity or two and set up autopay. Then you will have made a free choice that supports civil society and helps others to do good. It is gratifying to know that, whatever the course of events, you are helping others to do good. Many of us can afford to support some part of the vast network of charities that one of our former presidents called 1,000 points of light. These points of light are best seen, like stars at dusk, against the darkening sky. When Americans think of freedom, we usually imagine a contest between a lone individual and a powerful government. We tend to conclude that the individual should be empowered and the government kept at bay. This is all well and good, but one element of freedom is the choice of associates, and one defense of freedom is the activity of groups to sustain their members. This is why we should engage in activities that are of interest to us, our friends, our families. These need not be expressly political. Václav Havel, the Czech dissident thinker, gave the example of brewing good beer. Insofar as we take pride in these activities and come to know others who do so as well, we are creating civil society. Sharing in an undertaking teaches us that we can trust people beyond a narrow circle of friends and families and helps us to recognize authorities from whom we can learn. The capacity for trust and learning can make life seem less chaotic and mysterious and democratic politics more plausible and attractive. The anti-communist dissidents of Eastern Europe, facing a situation more extreme than ours, recognized the seemingly non-political activity of civil society as an expression and as a safeguard of freedom. They were right. In the 20th century, all the major enemies of freedom were hostile to non-governmental organizations, charities, and the like. Communists required all such groups to be officially registered and transformed them into institutions of control. Fascists created what they called a corporatist system, in which every human activity had its proper place, subordinated to the party state. Today's authoritarians, in India, Turkey, Russia, are also highly allergic to the idea of free associations and non-governmental organizations. Lesson 16. Learn from peers in other countries. Keep up your friendships abroad or make new friends in other countries. The present difficulties in the United States are an element of a larger trend, and no country is going to find a solution by itself. Make sure you and your family have passports. In the year before the president was elected, American journalists were often mistaken about his campaign. As he surmounted barrier after barrier and accumulated victory after victory, our commentariat assured us that at the next stage he would be stopped by one fine American institution or another. There was, meanwhile, one group of observers who took a different position, East Europeans and those who study Eastern Europe. To them, much about the president's campaign was familiar, and the final outcome was no surprise. Ukrainian and Russian journalists who sniffed the air in the Midwest said more realistic things than American pollsters who built careers on understanding the politics of their own country. To Ukrainians, Americans seemed comically slow to react to the obvious threats of cyber war and fake news. When Russian propaganda made Ukraine a target in 2013, young Ukrainian journalists and others reacted immediately, decisively, and sometimes humorously with campaigns to expose disinformation. Russia deployed many of the same techniques against Ukraine that it later used against the United States while invading Ukraine. When Russian media falsely claimed in 2014 that Ukrainian troops crucified a small boy, the Ukrainian response was rapid and effective, at least within Ukraine itself. When Russian media spread the story in 2016 that Hillary Clinton was ill because she mentioned an article on decision fatigue, which is not an illness, in an email, the story was spread by Americans. The Ukrainians won, and the Americans lost, in the sense that Russia failed to get the regime it wanted in its neighbor, but did see its preferred candidate triumph in the United States. This should give us pause. History, which for a time seemed to be running from west to east, now seems to be moving from east to west. Everything that happens here seems to happen there first. The fact that most Americans do not have passports has become a problem for American democracy. Sometimes Americans say that they do not need travel documents because they prefer to die defending freedom in America. These are fine words, but they miss an important point. The fight will be a long one. Even if it does require sacrifice, it first demands sustained attention to the world around us, so that we know what we are resisting and how best to do so. So having a passport is not a sign of surrender. On the contrary, it is liberating, since it creates the possibility of new experiences. It allows us to see how other people, sometimes wiser than we, react to similar problems. Since so much of what has happened in the last year is familiar to the rest of the world or from recent history, we must observe and listen. Lesson 17. Listen for dangerous words. Be alert to the use of the words extremism and terrorism. Be alive to the fatal notions of emergency and exception. Be angry about the treacherous use of patriotic vocabulary. The most intelligent of the Nazis, the legal theorist Carl Schmitt, explained in clear language the essence of fascist governance. The way to destroy all rules, he explained, was to focus on the idea of the exception. A Nazi leader outmaneuvers his opponents by manufacturing a general conviction that the present moment is exceptional, and then transforming that state of exception into a permanent emergency. Citizens then trade real freedom for fake safety. When politicians today invoke terrorism, they are speaking, of course, of an actual danger. But when they try to train us to surrender freedom in the name of safety, we should be on our guard. There is no necessary trade-off between the two. Sometimes we do indeed gain one by losing the other, and sometimes not. People who assure you that you can only gain security at the price of liberty usually want to deny you both. You can certainly concede freedom without becoming more secure. The feeling of submission to authority might be comforting, but it is not the same thing as actual safety. Likewise, gaining a bit of freedom may be unnerving, but this momentary unease is not dangerous. It is easy to imagine situations where we sacrifice both freedom and safety at the same time, when we enter an abusive relationship or vote for a fascist. Similarly, it is none too difficult to imagine choices that increase both freedom and safety, like leaving an abusive relationship or immigrating from a fascist state. It is the government's job to increase both freedom and security. Extremism certainly sounds bad, and governments often try to make it sound worse by using the word terrorism in the same sentence. But the word has little meaning. There is no doctrine called extremism. When tyrants speak of extremists, they just mean people who are not in the mainstream, as the tyrants themselves are defining that mainstream at that particular moment. Dissidents of the 20th century, whether they were resisting fascism or communism, were called extremists. Modern authoritarian regimes, such as Russia, use laws on extremism to punish those who criticize their policies. In this way, the notion of extremism comes to mean virtually everything except what is, in fact, extreme: tyranny. Lesson 18. Be calm when the unthinkable arrives. Modern tyranny is terror management. When the terrorist attack comes, remember that authoritarians exploit such events in order to consolidate power. The sudden disaster that requires the end of checks and balances, the dissolution of opposition parties, the suspension of freedom of expression, the right to a fair trial, and so on, is the oldest trick in the Hitlerian book. Do not fall for it. The Reichstag fire was the moment when Hitler's government, which came to power mainly through democratic means, became the menacingly permanent Nazi regime. It is the archetype of terror management. On February 27, 1933, at about 9 p.m., the building housing the German parliament, the Reichstag, began to burn. Who set the fire that night in Berlin? We don't know, and it doesn't really matter. What matters is that this spectacular act of terror initiated the politics of emergency. Gazing with pleasure at the flames that night, Hitler said, "This fire is just the beginning." Whether or not the Nazis set the fire, Hitler saw the political opportunity. There will be no mercy now. Anyone standing in our way will be cut down. The next day, a decree suspended the basic rights of all German citizens, allowing them to be preventatively detained by the police. On the strength of Hitler's claim that the fire was the work of Germany's enemies, the Nazi Party won a decisive victory in parliamentary elections on March 5th. The police and the Nazi paramilitaries began to round up members of left-wing political parties and place them in improvised concentration camps. On March 23rd, the new parliament passed an enabling act, which allowed Hitler to rule by decree. Germany then remained in a state of emergency for the next 12 years until the end of the Second World War. Hitler had used an act of terror, an event of limited inherent significance, to institute a regime of terror that killed millions of people and changed the world. The authoritarians of today are also terror managers, and if anything, they are rather more creative. Consider the current Russian regime, so admired by the American president. Vladimir Putin not only came to power in an incident that strikingly resembled the Reichstag fire, he then used a series of terror attacks, real, questionable, and fake, to remove obstacles to total power in Russia and to assault democratic neighbors. When Putin was appointed prime minister by a failing Boris Yeltsin in August 1999, Putin was an unknown with a nugatory approval rating. The following month, a series of buildings were bombed in Russian cities, apparently by the Russian secret state police. Its officers were arrested by their own colleagues with evidence of their guilt. In another case, the Speaker of the Russian Parliament announced an explosion a few days before it took place. Nonetheless, Putin declared a war of revenge against Russia's Muslim population in Chechnya, promising to pursue the supposed perpetrators and rub them out in the shithouse. The Russian nation rallied. Putin's approval rating skyrocketed. The following March, he won presidential elections. In 2002, after Russian security forces killed scores of Russian civilians while suppressing a real terrorist attack at a Moscow theater, Putin exploited the occasion to seize control of private television. After a school in Beslan was besieged by terrorists in 2004, in strange circumstances that suggested a provocation, Putin did away with the position of elected regional governors. Thus Putin's rise to power and his elimination of two major institutions, private television and elected regional governorships, were enabled by the management of real, fake, and questionable terrorism. After Putin returned to the presidency in 2012, Russia introduced terror management into its foreign policy. In its invasion of Ukraine in 2014, Russia transformed units of its own regular army into a terrorist force, removing insignia from uniforms and denying all responsibility for the dreadful suffering they inflicted. In the campaign for the Donbas region of southeastern Ukraine, Russia deployed Chechen irregulars and sent units of its regular army based in Muslim regions to join the invasion. Russia also tried, but failed, to hack the 2014 Ukrainian presidential election. In April 2015, Russian hackers took over the transmission of a French television station, pretended to be ISIS, and then broadcast material designed to terrorize France. Russia impersonated a cyber caliphate so that the French would fear terror more than they already did. The aim was presumably to drive voters to the far-right National Front, a party financially supported by Russia. After 130 people were killed and 368 injured in the terrorist attack on Paris of November 2015, the founder of a think tank close to the Kremlin rejoiced that terrorism would drive Europe towards fascism and Russia. Both fake and real Islamic terrorism in Western Europe, in other words, were thought to be in the Russian interest. In early 2016, Russia manufactured a moment of fake terror in Germany. While bombing Syrian civilians and thus driving Muslim refugees to Europe, Russia exploited a family drama to instruct Germans that Muslims were rapists of children. The aim, again, seems to have been to destabilize a democratic system and promote the parties of the extreme right. The previous September, the German government had announced that it would take 500,000 refugees from the war in Syria. Russia then began a bombing campaign in Syria that targeted civilians. Having provided the refugees, Russia then supplied the narrative. In January 2016, the Russian mass media spread a story that a girl of Russian origin in Germany, who had momentarily gone missing, had been serially raped by Muslim immigrants. With suspicious alacrity, right-wing organizations in Germany organized protests against the government. When the local police informed the population that no such rape had taken place, Russian media accused them of a cover-up. Even Russian diplomats joined the spectacle. When the American president and his national security advisor speak of fighting terrorism alongside Russia, what they are proposing to the American people is, in fact, terror management. The exploitation of real, dubious, and simulated terror attacks to bring down democracy. The Russian recap of the first telephone call between the president and Vladimir Putin is telling. The two men shared the opinion that it is necessary to join forces against the common enemy number one, international terrorism and extremism. For tyrants, the lesson of the Reichstag fire is that one moment of shock enables an eternity of submission. For us, the lesson is that our natural fear and grief must not enable the destruction of our institutions. Courage does not mean not fearing or not grieving. It does mean recognizing and resisting terror management right away from the moment of the attack, precisely when it seems most difficult to do so. James Madison nicely made the point that tyranny arises on some favorable emergency. After the Reichstag fire, Hannah Arendt wrote that, "I was no longer of the opinion that one can simply be a bystander." Lesson 19. Be a patriot. Set a good example of what America means for the generations to come. They will need it. What is patriotism? Let us begin with what patriotism is not. It is not patriotic to dodge the draft and to mock war heroes and their families. It is not patriotic to discriminate against active duty members of the armed forces in one's companies or to campaign to keep disabled veterans away from one's property. It is not patriotic to compare one's search for sexual partners in New York with the military service in Vietnam that one has dodged. It is not patriotic to avoid paying taxes, especially when American working families do pay. It is not patriotic to ask those working, tax-paying American families to finance one's own presidential campaign, and then to spend their contributions in one's own companies. It is not patriotic to admire foreign dictators. It is not patriotic to cultivate a relationship with Muammar Gaddafi, or to say that Bashar al-Assad and Vladimir Putin are superior leaders. It is not patriotic to call upon Russia to intervene in an American presidential election. It is not patriotic to cite Russian propaganda at rallies. It is not patriotic to share an advisor with Russian oligarchs. It is not patriotic to solicit foreign policy advice from someone who owns shares in a Russian energy company. It is not patriotic to read a foreign policy speech written by someone on the payroll of a Russian energy company. It is not patriotic to appoint a national security advisor who has taken money from a Russian propaganda organ. It is not patriotic to appoint a Secretary of State, an oil man with Russian financial interests, who is the director of a Russian-American energy company and has received the Order of Friendship from Putin. The point is not that Russia and America must be enemies. The point is that patriotism involves serving your own country. The president is a nationalist, which is not at all the same thing as a patriot. A nationalist encourages us to be our worst and then tells us that we are the best. A nationalist, although endlessly brooding on power, victory, defeat, revenge, wrote Orwell, tends to be uninterested in what happens in the real world. Nationalism is relativist, since the only truth is the resentment we feel when we contemplate others. As the novelist Danilo Kiche put it, nationalism has no universal values, aesthetic or ethical. A patriot, by contrast, wants the nation to live up to its ideals, which means asking us to be our best selves. A patriot must be concerned with the real world, which is the only place where his country can be loved and sustained. A patriot has universal values, standards by which he judges his nation, always wishing it well, and wishing that it would do better. Democracy failed in Europe in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s, and it is failing not only in much of Europe, but in many parts of the world today. It is that history and experience that reveals to us the dark range of our possible futures. A nationalist will say that it can't happen here, which is the first step toward disaster. A patriot says that it could happen here, but that we will stop it. Lesson 20. Be as courageous as you can. If none of us is prepared to die for freedom, then all of us will die under tyranny. Epilogue. History and Liberty. In Shakespeare's drama Hamlet, the hero is a virtuous man who is rightly shocked by the abrupt rise of an evil ruler. Haunted by visions, overcome by nightmares, lonely and estranged, he feels that he must reconstruct his sense of time. "The time is out of joint," says Hamlet, "O cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right." Our time is certainly out of joint. We have forgotten history for one reason, and, if we are not careful, we will neglect it for another. We will have to repair our own sense of time if we wish to renew our commitment to liberty. Until recently, we Americans had convinced ourselves that there was nothing in the future but more of the same. The seemingly distant traumas of fascism, Nazism, and communism seemed to be receding into irrelevance. We allowed ourselves to accept the politics of inevitability, the sense that history could move in only one direction, toward liberal democracy. After communism in Eastern Europe came to an end in 1989 to 1991, we imbibed the myth of an end of history. In so doing, we lowered our defenses, constrained our imagination, and opened the way for precisely the kinds of regimes we told ourselves could never return. To be sure, the politics of inevitability seem at first glance to be a kind of history. Inevitability politicians do not deny that there is a past, a present, and a future. They even allow for the colorful variety of the distant past. Yet they portray the present simply as a step toward a future that we already know, one of expanding globalization, deepening reason, and growing prosperity. This is what is called a teleology, a narration of time that leads toward a certain, usually desirable goal. Communism also offered a teleology, promising an inevitable socialist utopia. When that story was shattered a quarter century ago, we drew the wrong conclusion. Rather than rejecting teleologies, we imagined that our own story was true. The politics of inevitability is a self-induced intellectual coma. So long as there was a contest between communist and capitalist systems, and so long as the memory of fascism and Nazism was alive, Americans had to pay some attention to history and preserve the concepts that allowed them to imagine alternative futures. Yet once we accepted the politics of inevitability, we assumed that history was no longer relevant. If everything in the past is governed by a known tendency, then there is no need to learn the details. The acceptance of inevitability stilted the way we talked about politics in the 21st century. It stifled policy debate, intended to generate party systems where one political party defended the status quo, while the other proposed total negation. We learned to say that there was no alternative to the basic order of things, a sensibility that the Lithuanian political theorist Leonidas Donskis called liquid evil. Once inevitability was taken for granted, criticism indeed became slippery. What appeared to be critical analysis often assumed that the status quo could not actually change, and thereby indirectly reinforced it. Some spoke critically of neoliberalism, the sense that the idea of the free market had somehow crowded out all the others. This was true enough, but the very use of the word was usually a kowtow before an unchangeable hegemony. Other critics spoke of the need for disruption, borrowing a term from the analysis of technological innovations. When applied to politics, it again carries the implication that nothing can really change, that the chaos that excites us will eventually be absorbed by a self-regulating system. The man who runs naked across a football field certainly disrupts, but he does not change the rules of the game. The whole notion of disruption is adolescent. It assumes that after the teenagers make a mess, the adults will come and clean it up. But there are no adults. We own this mess. The second anti-historical way of considering the past is the politics of eternity. Like the politics of inevitability, the politics of eternity performs a masquerade of history, though a different one. It is concerned with the past, but in a self-absorbed way, free of any real concern with facts. Its mood is a longing for past moments that never really happened during epochs that were, in fact, disastrous. Eternity politicians bring us the past as a vast, misty courtyard of illegible monuments to national victimhood, all of them equally distant from the present, all of them equally accessible for manipulation. Every reference to the past seems to involve an attack by some external enemy upon the purity of the nation. National populists are eternity politicians. Their preferred reference point is the era when democratic republics seemed vanquished and their Nazi and Soviet rivals unstoppable, the 1930s. Those who advocated Brexit, the departure of the United Kingdom from the European Union, imagined a British nation-state, though such a thing never existed. There was a British Empire, and then there was Britain as a member of the European Union. The move to separate from the EU is not a step backward onto firm ground, but a leap into the unknown. Eerily, when judges said that a parliamentary vote was required for Brexit, a British tabloid called them enemies of the people, a Stalinist term from the show trials of the 1930s. The National Front in France urges voters to reject Europe in the name of an imaginary pre-war French nation-state. But France, like Britain, has never existed without either an empire or a European project. Leaders of Russia, Poland, and Hungary alike make similar gestures towards a glowing image of the 1930s. In his 2016 campaign, and again in his inaugural address, the American president used the slogan, America First, which is the name of a committee that sought to prevent the United States from opposing Nazi Germany. The president's strategic advisor promises policies that will be as exciting as the 1930s. And when exactly was the again in the president's slogan, Make America Great Again? Hint, it's the same again that we find in Never Again. The president himself has described a regime change in the style of the 1930s as the solution to the problems of the present. You know what solves it? When the economy crashes, when the country goes to total hell and everything is a disaster. What we need, he thinks, are riots to go back to where we used to be when we were great. In the politics of eternity, the seduction by a mythicized past prevents us from thinking about possible futures. The habit of dwelling on victimhood dulls the impulse of self-correction. Since the nation is defined by its inherent virtue rather than by its future potential, politics becomes a contemplation of good and evil rather than a discussion of possible solutions to real problems. Because the crisis is permanent, the sense of emergency is always present. Planning for the future seems impossible or even disloyal. How can we even think of reform when the enemy is always at the gate? If the politics of inevitability is like a coma, the politics of eternity is like hypnosis. We stare at the spinning vortex of cyclical myth until we fall into a trance, and then we do something shocking at someone else's orders. The danger we now face is of a passage from the politics of inevitability to the politics of eternity, from a naive and flawed sort of democratic republic to a confused and cynical sort of fascist oligarchy. The politics of inevitability is terribly vulnerable to the kind of shock it has just received. When something shatters the myth, when our time falls out of joint, we scramble to find some other way to organize what we experience. The path of least resistance leads directly from inevitability to eternity. If you once believed that that everything always turns out well in the end, you can be persuaded that nothing turns out well in the end. If you once did nothing because you thought progress was inevitable, then you can continue to do nothing because you think time moves in repeating cycles. Both of these positions, inevitability and eternity, are anti-historical. The only thing that stands between them is history itself. History allows us to see patterns and make judgments. It sketches for us the structures within which we can seek freedom. It reveals moments, each one of them different, none entirely unique. To understand one moment is to see the possibility of being the co-creator of another. History permits us to be responsible, not for everything, but for something. The Polish poet Czesław Miłosz thought that such a notion of responsibility worked against loneliness and indifference. History gives us the company of those who have done and suffered more than we. By embracing the politics of inevitability, we raise the generation without history. How will these young Americans react now that the promise of inevitability has been so obviously broken? Perhaps they will slide from inevitability towards eternity. It must be hoped that they could instead become a historical generation, rejecting the traps of inevitability and eternity that older generations have laid before them. One thing is certain. If young people do not begin to make history, politicians of eternity and inevitability will destroy it. And to make history, young Americans will have to know some. This is not the end, but a beginning. The time is out of joint, O cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right. Thus Hamlet. Yet he concludes, Nay, come, let's go together. This is Timothy Snyder. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. This program was produced and directed by Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2017 by Timothy Snyder. Production copyright 2017 by Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.